These seminars are about the good, the beautiful, and the true, which Plato identified as the three highest values. So I suppose this seminar is going to be about the true, in that what I'm going to be looking at is the nature of reality, both particularly as it's been explored by some Western philosophers, and how this can help us perhaps appreciate some of what the Buddha was saying in his understanding of the nature of reality. I have to say that this is a huge topic. In fact, it's completely mad for me to even think about trying to talk about it in the time available. So, I'm not going to be able to do it comprehensively, although probably I'll try, and I might come unstuck. So, but I hope what I'll be able to do is just give you a flavour of, something about the problematic nature of reality as we experience it. Problematic in all sorts of ways. Western philosophers have generally approached it as problematic in a cognitive sense. The Buddha approached it in a much more thoroughgoing way than that. He saw that it wasn't just a cognitive problem, it was an emotional problem, a spiritual problem, you name it, it's a problem for us. So where to start? Well, I thought actually maybe I'd say something about my own interest. Well, I won't say very much about my own interest in this. Something that's quite close to my heart, something that I've been interested in for years. I studied philosophy at university after reading Bertrand Russell's very short book called The Problems of Philosophy, and I thought, yes, this is what I want to understand. This is what I want to look at. I think I had that moment. Brian McGee says, if you're going to be a philosopher, you have to have had a moment where you've thought, isn't it amazing that anything exists? Most people, I don't think, have those moments, but I can vividly remember having such a moment on a train, just thinking, wow, it's just incredible that anything exists at all. Because it is, isn't it? You wouldn't really expect it to. It's much more likely for there to be nothing. But actually, there isn't nothing. There is something, and not just something. There is this amazing world that we live in and confront and try to navigate day after day. Well, I'm hoping to do a little trip through Western philosophy and some Western philosophers and some of their ideas. But I want to start with the Buddha. I was a bit afraid that I get so carried away with the philosophy that I would neglect the Buddha, and I don't want to do that, because the whole point of this is to see how Western philosophy can actually help to appreciate the Buddha's teaching. So there is, of course, a big difference between Western philosophy and Buddhism. Western philosophy deals almost entirely in concepts and the tools of the rational mind, whereas the Buddha never saw himself as a philosopher. He dealt with our experience. He wanted us to look at directly at our experience, and his attainment of enlightenment, which he spent his life trying to convey how we too could share in that experience, he realised was only very partially communicable in concepts. Essentially, it's not conceptual. However, having said that, both Buddhism and Western philosophy are seeking to discover the truth about the way things are. The Buddha, the name the Buddha, means one who is awake, one who is awake to the way things are. That's how he's often described. One who sees things as they really are. So what does this mean? Well, one thing it means is that the rest of us don't see things as they really are. The Buddha from his enlightened perspective, the Buddha saw that we were all in a complete mess because we don't see things in the way they are. Very difficult, obviously. Well, it was very difficult for the Buddha, when he attained enlightenment, to even think of how he was going to try and teach other people to attain the same thing. He nearly gave up. Most of you probably know this, that he nearly decided not to and had to be persuaded by Brahma Sahampati to actually go ahead and teach. Because it's very difficult for any of us to appreciate what the enlightened mind might be, but one way of looking at it is that it is a mind that is completely freed from the normal constraints that we, our unenlightened minds, our unenlightened consciousness, has to deal with. The enlightened mind is completely free. It's free and it sees things with the eye of wisdom, and it and this results in an outpouring of compassion. So the Buddha tried to he tried to identify what the problems are, of unenlightened humanity and how we see the world. And so, just very briefly, what we could say is that the fundamental truth that the Buddha saw was conditionality. Now, I'm sort of not going to go into this very much, and I'm sort of going to assume some of you know something about the Buddha's teaching, but this fundamental teaching of the Buddha that things arise in dependence upon conditions, and when those conditions are no longer there, the things that have arisen cease to be. Going into that in a little more detail, the way he saw reality was, the way he saw our approach to it is that we take what is impermanent to be permanent, we take what is insubstantial to be substantial, and we take what we take to be pleasant and fulfilling is actually only going to lead us to suffering, is actually deeply unsatisfactory. So it seems that from his enlightened perspective, he saw that reality was not in any way fixed. It is not a given. It is constantly changing, and because of conditionality, everything is deeply interconnected. But we don't really see that. Well, we may see it, you know, it's not difficult to see that things are impermanent, but we don't live as if they are. And because we persist in not seeing reality the way it is, we suffer, and we cause other people to suffer. So, for the Buddha, the way he saw it was that we are not separate little egos bombing around in the world, coming up against a fixed world, trying to deal with it. It is not like that at all. He had a very dynamic perspective on it. And what he realised was not... He didn't fall into a kind of nihilistic... Because this is how you can sometimes go if you look at the Buddha's teaching. You can think, well, it's very nihilistic. Everything's impermanent. Nothing's got any kind of substantial reality. Everything's unsatisfactory, so we might as well just pack up and go home. Or, you know, we might as well just enjoy ourselves, or we might kill ourselves, but, where do we go with that? But, of course, the Buddha's experience was such that actually when we deeply penetrate that truth, we find ourselves in the unconditioned. And when we find ourselves in the unconditioned, there's not really much more that can be said. So I'm going to move on now to look at Western philosophy, because the two things they do have in common is that Western philosophy has realised that the way we normally see the world is not the way it is. And it has philosophers of various kinds have tried to think their way into a deeper understanding of reality. Some maybe with more success than others, and some of them have taken a route which takes us in a different direction to the Buddha's understanding, but some of them have actually moved in a direction which actually almost knocks on the door of the Buddha's understanding. And that's what's fascinated me in recent years, just seeing how the minds of these philosophers, where their thinking about reality has taken them. So I'm going to start with just saying, well, what is our normal view of reality? And I think if you kind of asked Joe Bloggs in the street and said, what is reality? He or she would probably be quite mystified by the question. And they might say something like, it's all this, isn't it? It's all this. most people probably wouldn't get much further than that. What is reality? Well, reality is what is out there. So I think most of us, for most of the time, have this view of reality that the world is a set of given things. It's a set of external objects which we get access to through our sense experience. So we use our sight, our hearing, our sense of smell, taste, touch to access the world. So that's a general common sense view, that the world is there and we're very fortunate that we're able to access that world through the use of our senses. Not only access it, but we can describe it, we can analyse it, we can classify it, we can predict it, we can do all sorts of things with it. And the growth of modern science has showed us that this is wonderful, and it enables us to live in a world which is, in lots of ways, runs a lot more smoothly and is much easier for us to live in than it was for primitive men and women thousands of years ago. But it doesn't take much reflection, actually, to see that it's not quite as simple as that. So where do I start with that? Well, I thought actually I would start very briefly with René Descartes, who is often seen as the father of modern philosophy. And Descartes, most of you, you may well know that Descartes was probably one of the first people to do a good thought experiment. Thought experiments are these things which stretch your mind into imagining situations which help you to see things and understand them a little bit more deeply. And Descartes went through a very thoroughgoing thought experiment where he decided to doubt the existence of everything. And he found that he could do this very easily. Because we know, don't we, that our senses sometimes deceive us. So if our senses sometimes deceive us, maybe they're deceiving us all the time. How do we know that anything in this supposed external world actually exists at all? Maybe it's all a figment of our imagination. So he systematically decided to doubt the existence of absolutely everything. But he came up against something that he couldn't doubt. And what he couldn't doubt was his own experience of doubting. And that led to his famous aphorism, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. So that conclusion that I'm thinking this, I'm doubting this, therefore I at least must exist. And what's interesting about that is that this was a kind of bedrock. What he arrived at was the primacy of the subject, the primacy of subjective, the subject having an experience. And I think this wasn't properly appreciated till quite a bit later. And he then proceeded in a way which is slightly dubious, to reconstruct the rest of the external world. But in a way, the die was cast with that, because once you start doubting your experience, it's never quite the same again. And philosophers from then onwards started to really realise they needed to really look at, is the external world really the way we perceive it to be? So that instead of it being a simple case that our senses give us access to the world as it is, we realise that we are totally dependent on our senses to give us information. And how do we know that our senses are giving us accurate information? You've probably all come across, I just want to sort of run through a little bit of why we might doubt this common view sense of the world. And one thing quite a famous way of doing this is, you've probably all heard this, question: if a tree falls in the middle of the night when no one is around, does it make a sound? And it's one of those interesting little conundrums, because what you want to say is, well, of course it does. A tree falling in the middle of the night is going to make a sound. Just because no one's there to hear it doesn't mean it's not making a sound. But when we start to look at that, we think, well, how can it be? How can it? Because a sound depends on somebody hearing it. If there are no ears, there can be no sounds. Of course, it could be a recording device. And of course, we know there are sound waves coming off the tree. But sound waves don't do anything unless they're actually received. So right away, we have this realization that what is going on in the external world is in some ways dependent on us. And it's not just a simple case of we are just here receiving a world that's out there. And I think this is really very important as a way of just loosening up our sense of ourselves and the world, something that the Buddha said was really, really important, that we too tend to be terribly fixed in our preconceptions about ourselves and the world. Okay, so I'm going to introduce you to a couple of key terms here. If you've done any philosophy, you probably know them. So, these are terms which have been used by philosophers, especially from the time of Kant onwards. But I thought I'd tell you about them now. First of all, there is phenomena. Now, we use the term phenomena in a kind of loose sense anyway, but in a philosophical sense, what it means is everything that we perceive through the senses. In fact, you could say, well, it's everything. It's everything. Everything that we perceive, whether we see it, hear it, taste it, touch it, smell it, is phenomena. Noumena is what philosophers have liked to say, or various philosophers have tried to say, underlines phenomena. What Kant called the thing in itself, an underlying substance which gives rise to our sense experience. And this distinction, I'll probably keep coming back to this distinction, because it has sort of bedeviled Western philosophy. And some of you may know, if you've read Sangharakshita's Survey of Buddhism, the shortest sentence in his first... I mean, Sangharakshita is known for his long sentences, but there's one very short sentence in his first chapter, which is that noumena do not exist. So, in a very uncompromising way, there is a sense in which Buddhism rigorously refuses to acknowledge the existence of noumena, of anything underlying phenomena. However, that's not quite the end of the story. I'll come back to that. Okay, now I must apologise for these very scrappy little bits of flip chart. It's about all I could manage. But I thought, well, they might be quite handy just so that I know where I'm going, which might assist you in knowing where I'm going as well. Okay. So I'm going to say a little bit about these big names in philosophy. Okay, so we have Locke, Berkeley, Hume, Kant, and we also have Schopenhauer. Oops, I'm not supposed to anyway, I'll leave that for now. Okay, so after Descartes we have Locke, John Locke, British philosopher, and he thought, well, yes, it's certainly true that we have a problem. Trees falling in the middle of the night, I don't know whether he used that example, but he could see that there were certain qualities in objects which made no sense at all without someone to be perceiving them. And he went right through those things like colour, sound, smell, whether something's hot or cold, all sorts of things which are dependent on someone perceiving them. And these he called secondary qualities. But he said, nevertheless, all everything has primary qualities which are actually there and which do not depend on somebody actually perceiving them. Because, in fact, it does seem a bit absurd to say that nothing exists unless there's someone there to perceive it. It's a tricky one. I think there's an example of one example I had is of an apple pie. If you cook an apple pie, I never cook apple pie, so I don't know quite why I'm thinking of this. But if I was to cook an apple pie and I put it in the oven, and then I decided to go down the shops and there's no one else in the house, well, I might imagine that it's cooking and it's giving off all sorts of lovely smells. But if there's no one there to smell it, what does it mean to say it's giving off smells? So we've got the same problems we have with the tree. If there's no noses, there can't be any smells. But nevertheless, even though there's no one there to know what's going on, something must be going on, because when I come back from the shops, it will be cooked. And if I spend too long at the shops, it will be burnt to a crisp. So something is going on in the absence of any perceiver. And it is something going on that Locke tried to say was a sort of independent substratum from experience. Sangharakshita, again in the Survey of Buddhism, says this idea of substance as something separate has vitiated Western philosophy from that day to this. So after Locke came somebody who has a sort of brief appearance in Western philosophy called Bishop Berkeley. And Berkeley, I think, was a bit of a genius, actually. Because what he said was, well, this nonsense about a substratum independent of experience, this is just an invention. If we can't actually perceive it going on, if we've no way of perceiving that, how on earth do we know that it exists? So he took the big radical step of saying, actually, nothing exists apart from our sense experience. So it's only what actually comes to us through our senses that exists. And as for the problem as to how something goes on existing when there's no one there to perceive it, he had a brainwave. God sees it. It's actually marvellous. It's absolute genius. Because not only did he manage to come up with this amazing philosophical insight, but he managed to prove the existence of God at the same time. So what he said was that everything in reality exists in the mind of God. So we can be sure that it really, really exists. Incidentally, I think something I think is worth mentioning is that this kind of common sense view that we have, that the world is as it appears to us, I think is particularly strong because of our Christian conditioning, our sort of Judeo-Christian conditioning, where, after all, God is the creator God. He created the world. So what we've inherited is a view that God has created the world for us. And of course, God wouldn't deceive us. So the world must be as we perceive it. So there's Berkeley. God, everything exists in the mind of God. Well, as Brian McGee points out, when God finds his way into a philosophical argument, it's not usually difficult to get him out again. This was the job of Hume, David Hume, Scottish philosopher, very down to earth. He's a giant of philosophy. First of all, he said, well, actually, Bishop Berkeley, I don't think he said it to his face, in fact, I'm not sure they were even contemporaries, but he said, actually, you know what you said about there's no evidence whatsoever for this substratum of reality? Well, actually, there's also no evidence whatsoever for God. So, you know, if you're going to throw one out, you've got to throw the other out as well. So Hume is seen as the great empiricist. Empiricism is a philosophy which says that what is real is what we can experience. And although he understood what Berkeley said, he said, yes, there is nothing other than sense experience. But sense experience, he went back to the common sense view, if you like, and he said, well, sense experience, we can't know that it's real, but it's all we have. So actually it's a waste of time trying to wonder whether it's real or not. It's all we have, and we have to take it very seriously. You know, it's no good me standing in front of a 10-ton truck bearing down on me and saying, oh, well, I know this is just a set of sense data, it's not real, because that 10-ton truck has the power to completely annihilate me, and there won't be much philosophising going on then. So Hume, very... pragmatic and down to earth, said, well, we need to take our sense experience seriously, and our sense experience is all there is. That is reality. And what this led him to was some quite interesting asides, because he was so rigorous in this, he started to question all sorts of things which we take to be real, but which are actually outside of our sense experience, including causality. Now, this is a huge topic, and I haven't got time to go into it. We are actually going to come across it again in a couple of weeks' time. But just very, very briefly, what he said was, he used the classic example of a billiard ball. Billiard ball comes along, hits another billiard ball, which moves. We assume that first billiard ball is causing second billiard ball to move. Fair enough. But he says, there's absolutely no way we can see causality in that event. All we see is one billiard ball hitting another and another one moving. This might happen over and over again, but all we see is one event and then another event. We can't actually prove that one is causing the other. So anyway, that's what he says about that. Interesting enough, the Buddhist, what gets nearest, one of the people you could say is nearest to a Buddhist philosopher, really, someone called Nagarjuna, argued much the same thing, actually. Sort of in the, when was Nagarjuna? Fourth, I can't remember, a few centuries anyway, a few centuries after the Buddha. The other thing, interestingly, that Hume said was that our sense of self is a complete fiction. Again, echoing what Buddhists have said, and what the Buddha tried very, very hard to put this message across. He was dealing with, the Buddha was dealing with Hindus who had a very strong view that there is an immortal soul, an immortal self, which goes on between lives. And the Buddha was concerned to take apart that view. And if you know his teaching on the five skandhas, this is his teaching, which says, okay, we have form, we have feeling, we have thought, we have volitions, we have consciousness, but where is the self? Hume said much the same thing. He said, all we have is our experience, our sense experience. Where do we find a self? All we find is a set of experiences. We can't find a self. Now, one problem with Hume, well, I don't know if it's a problem, but what this actually led to was a very thoroughgoing scientific materialism. Because if there is nothing other than our sense experience, then anything to do with religion, anything to do with ethics and metaphysics goes out of the window. Hume said this very, very strongly. He said, if it contains information that we can access through our senses, or he allowed what's called a priori knowledge of mathematics and logic, that's just inner processes, but if we're trying to say anything about reality which isn't about sense experience, then basically we're talking nonsense. And this view found its way. In a way, you could say this is a sort of British line of philosophy. British philosophy tended to go in that direction. And in the early 20th century, we had a group of philosophers called logical positivists who took this to its extreme and said that basically if something isn't... if we can't access something through sense experience, not only does it not exist, but it's meaningless. It's actually nonsense. You just cannot talk about it. Sadly, they got this idea from Wittgenstein. I wasn't going to go into this because this is a bit silly, but I can't not mention Wittgenstein, because Wittgenstein, who actually was of the German tradition, which I'll come to in a moment, what Wittgenstein had written, what was thought to be an absolute work of genius, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, and he had seemed to suggest that our language mirrors the world, and everything we talk about, we can only talk about what we perceive in the world. And that if we try to talk about anything outside that, well, basically, we can't. Logical positivists took him to mean that actually you literally can't talk about anything because it doesn't exist. What Wittgenstein actually meant, and he says this very clearly, is that we can't talk about things outside sense experience, but they are actually the only things that are really important. So what he wants to draw is the limits of our language, but he says when we've done that, all things that are important remain untouched. So Wittgenstein didn't want to say that there wasn't any kind, anything spiritual, transcendental, ethical, aesthetic. He wasn't trying to say that's nonsense. He's just saying we can't really adequately talk about it, which is fair enough. Anyway, so logical positivists, scientific materialism tended to go in a very atheistic, non-spiritual direction. That was British philosophy. I'm oversimplifying terribly here, by the way. If there's any philosophy experts, you're probably wincing. But anyway, if we look at the German tradition, we have Kant. How did you describe Kant?
The
all-pulverizer. Okay. Kant always says that he was woken up from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume. That it was reading Hume that really got him into philosophy. Now, I've written the noumenon here because Kant that introduced the term the noumenon into philosophy. He wasn't prepared to accept that reality was just our sense experience. He just would not accept that. And one of the things that, I'd say probably the great contribution of Kant to philosophy is that he saw that sense experience in itself isn't anything very much. What is important is what we do with it, with our minds. And he had this amazing insight, actually. Just incredible. How we perceive the world depends on the structure of our minds. And I think maybe he was led to this partly by feeling uneasy about what Hume had said about causality. Because he could see what Hume meant, that you couldn't prove that one thing caused another. But nevertheless, our whole understanding of the world depends on an understanding of causality. If we didn't have this understanding of causality, that one thing causes another, then our experience would make no sense to us. Everything would come in, but we would make no sense of it. Certainly science would be impossible. Science depends absolutely on causality. So the insight he had was that we perceive the world through certain categories, one of which is causality. We cannot actually perceive the world without causality. It makes no sense to us. Equally, we have to perceive it as being in space and in time. One thing has to follow another, and everything arranges itself in space. Now, what's coming at me in my sense experience is a whole multitude of different things. If I sort of try to keep my mind out of it for a moment, what is the actual experience, and you could do this yourself, you look around you, the actual experience is of a mass of maybe shapes and colours and just a whole multifarious mass coming at you. But instantly the brain organises it, and it organises it in space. And we cannot imagine it any other way. So, and this becomes clear, just in case you're, just to sort of make this a little bit clearer, this becomes clear when we consider things like we can't think outside of space and time. So if we try the question, well, is space finite or infinite? If we say space is finite, we immediately have to say, but what's outside space? It is a nonsensical question. But we still want to say that. It's the same with time. If we say time had a beginning, we say, well, what happened before that? So again, we're using temporal terms, spatial terms, because we cannot conceive of a limit to time and space. But if we are to say, if we said, no, they're infinite, we come across another problem. If space is infinite, then we can have no location. There can only be location within bounds. Sometimes it's easier to see this with time. If time were infinite, if there was no beginning to time, there could be no present moment, because you'd never get there. If infinite time had to elapse before you got to the present moment, you'd never get there. So that's just an example of how we cannot think outside of space and time. And this was Kant's great insight, that our minds think and perceive through the categories of space and time and causality. Phew, right, okay. So, I think I need a breather here. Where do we go from here? Okay. So far, how does this help us in any sense to get more of a handle on the Buddha's teaching? Well, what it does for me anyway is it loosens up my sense of myself and the world, my sense of subject and object. It helps me to see that I play a part in constructing the world that I move around in. It helps me to see that I'm deeply connected with everything that I come up against. And everything is deeply connected with me. And this is part of the Buddha's insight. What the Buddha was trying to show us is that if we... What the Buddha was trying to say is that we need to... It needs to make a difference, not just to the way we think, but the way we act. And therefore his whole path of ethics, meditation and wisdom was there to help us penetrate this truth about reality, that we are all deeply interconnected. And certain aspects of Western philosophy helped me to get a feel for that. And I think more than anyone else, there is one philosopher who I think is really helpful in this respect, and that is Schopenhauer. And I haven't got time to do anything like justice to Schopenhauer, but he will come up again in a couple of weeks' time when we look at free will and conditionality. But Schopenhauer had some very, very interesting things to say about the nature of reality and about our place in it. Now, he was a great admirer of Kant. But the one thing he felt that Kant hadn't properly understood or hadn't properly wrote about or caused other people to understand was his treatment of the noumenon. Okay. So Kant felt himself convinced, maybe because he was a deeply religious man, that there had to be more to reality than our sense experience. So there had to be more than just phenomena. What he said was that there had to be an underlying reality which gave rise to our sense experience. There couldn't just be sense experience. However much it's mediated through these categories of the mind, there had to be something in reality underpinning our sense experience. And this he called the thing in itself, or the noumenon. Schopenhauer said, Kant, sorry, but you can't say that. You have already said that causality is part of the structure of our minds and that it only applies to phenomena. Okay? We cannot, our sense experience, the phenomenal world, phenomena, only come to us, only make sense to us through causality. But causality can only apply to phenomena. You can't say that the noumenon is the cause of phenomena. It's just not logical. So Kant, I think, was dead by this time, so he couldn't tell it right. Schopenhauer took issue with Kant over this. But Schopenhauer also didn't want to go the way either of the kind of thoroughgoing empiricism of there is nothing other than sense experience and that's what reality is. He also didn't want to go the other way, which some other philosophers have gone, which was to say, well, actually, it's all mind. Everything is in the mind. There is no matter. There's no external reality. It's all in the mind. He felt that both were deeply flawed ways of looking at it. Okay, where do I go with this very briefly? What he was interested in was the connection between subject and object. Okay, the connection between subject and object. And he said, well, the problem with Hume's thoroughgoing empiricism is that it seems to posit the reality of the external world, but doesn't take seriously the subject who is perceiving it. And the problem with the what were called idealist philosophers that said everything was in the mind is that it put all the emphasis on the subject and didn't take seriously enough the objective content of perception. So he said, well, actually, subject and object are absolutely mutually dependent on each other. You can't have one without the other. There is we're back in a way to Bishop Berkeley, that you cannot have subject without object. But that doesn't mean that there is no objective reality, just that it is completely dependent on the subject. And we only have access to sense experience, we only have access to phenomena, but he was convinced, like Kant, that there was what he called the noumenal. There was a deeper, much deeper sense of reality than just phenomena. So, just what I love about this is that it starts to what Schopenhauer wanted us to do is really look at our own experience. And he said, well, if there was nothing but sense experience, if it was just phenomena, why would we care about it? He said, as human beings, we are quite unique in the way we are positioned as regards to our experience. And if it was just phenomena, we wouldn't have that sense of really caring about it. We wouldn't have that. We wouldn't have that sense of being fascinated by the world. And most important of all, we wouldn't be able to really connect with other people. There's, empathy is really quite a remarkable thing, and it cannot be explained just by the phenomenal world. We have a sense of oneness. We have a sense of shared experience. We can feel for other people. And Schopenhauer felt that this wouldn't actually happen if there wasn't something noumenal, in a way, sustaining the phenomenal world. But he didn't want to make the same mistake as Kant and try to think of some explanation of the connection between the noumenal and the phenomenal world. And what he thought was, well, actually, we've got to go about it in a completely different way. And this is where I start to think there's a really interesting parallel, but I'm on dodgy ground here, so I can't completely get away with this. But there is a sort of interesting parallel between what Schopenhauer says about the relationship between the phenomenal and the noumenal. There's a parallel with the Buddhist teaching on the conditioned and the unconditioned. Both of them cannot be talked about, really. Both of them are not objects of sense experience. And both of them, according to Schopenhauer, can only be accessed through inner experience. I think I'm running out of time here, so I'm not really going to be able to say any more than this. I must just say this. What Schopenhauer drew attention to was that we, each of us, have unique access to our inner experience. And philosophers have just neglected this whole thing, this whole aspect of experience. They've always looked out there, sense experience. But actually, although we can look at ourselves as objects, just as we look at other people as objects, I mean objects in the sense of an object of experience, we also can really have a knowledge, an inner knowledge of ourselves, which nobody else has access to. And of course, we all know that if we're meditators. When we meditate, our kind of awareness and meditative states of consciousness are vast and deep and rich. And they're nothing to do with sense experience. And they're not even in space, barely in time. And Schopenhauer started to go in this direction of seeing that that sort of depth of experience seemed to go beyond those categories of space, time and causality that Kant said we had to experience things through. And I'm going to stop there because I could go off another half hour on what he, on his idea about the will. Acts of will coming from within. I'd really like to go into that, but I'm not going to have time. Hopefully it will come up again. So I'm really sorry because I knew that I wasn't going to be able to contain it in the time available, but we do have actually a few minutes if anybody would like to ask anything or say anything. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think very much you see that actually a bit of an incredible sort of tour through Western philosophy. But to me, when you talk about you started with Descartes, if you think of the life of a philosopher, they sit there contemplating from a study, looking at the outside world. Mm. So they ask, in here and out there. Mm. Right? Do all the philosophising like that, in that kind of polar way. And they shut the philosophy books up, and they go home, they go on the bus, get off the bus, go to the pub, talk to their mates, go home, see their wife, or if they're a woman, see their husband, or whatever, you know. And it's as if almost the philosophy that they're doing in the study doesn't quite relate to all these other kind of experiences they have during the day. Because when you talk about the in here and the out there, there's actually a third term, which is the relationship between the two.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And if you assume that that's the thing that's real, whether you question either pole of it, it doesn't really matter. Mm. What's important is the fact that we all know that we're in relationship to something.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, the only two philosophers that even started going down that road were the near contemporaries of Descartes, which were Spinoza and Leibniz. Leibniz broke the world down into percepts, what he called, which was that relationship, or monads, as he called them, which had a remarkable similarity to the early Buddhist philosophy of Dharmism. And, of course, Spinoza said, well, the problem that Descartes then got into was, you said he rather dubiously built the world back up again, because he built this totally dualistic world, and he tumbled over the problem of how does the outer and the inner world connect together. And Spinoza said, well, it's pretty simple. He said, they've never been apart in the first place for the real person. They're not separate bits. And it's almost as if the rest of the, you know, Western philosophy up until the time of Fichte, Schelling and Hegel, which took the philosophy from Kant forward and put it on a dynamic basis, it was only then they really started going back and properly understanding Spinoza and Leibniz and developing a more dynamic philosophy which understands a world of practice rather than a world of theory and looks at it in that way, which I see as being related, in my understanding, much closer to the world of Pratitya Samuppada, that interrelationship and so on, how the world is interconnected in that way rather than being just a static object to subject.
Well, I'm sure you're right, and I'm sure that there could be a whole other talk on Spinoza and Leibniz. I'm not an expert on Spinoza and Leibniz. I don't know very much about them, but I recognise what you're saying. But I'm sure that's true, and I also recognise what you're saying about philosophers have had a tendency, probably, and I don't know that's even necessarily different with Spinoza and Leibniz, they have had a tendency to see it as they're here and the world's there and they're going to pontificate about it without actually being interested in, as you say, the relationship between them and the world and trying to transform themselves in that knowledge. Interestingly, Karl Marx is famous for saying, philosophers have so far sought to interpret the world. The point, however, is to change it. And Marx, being I think the term is dialectical materialist, of course, just saw the world and he wanted to change the world. Schopenhauer, I think, did move quite a long way towards seeing the necessity to transform our own experience. And he was very interested in Buddhism. I would like to have said quite a lot more about Schopenhauer because it relates to Buddhism directly, but sadly, as I knew, I ran out of time. But thank you. Yeah. I would like to actually read more Spinoza and Leibniz. I think they are interesting. Anything else?
One of the ideas that I'm interested in is, I think one of the things that the Buddha was saying was that the conditions in this particular universe, if you see a whole line of Buddhas coming into play, this is one particular Buddha, the historical Buddha is one Buddha among the long line of Buddhas. And one of the things that supposedly that I understand he was saying was that the conditions in this particular universe, if you like, in this particular planet, that all the conditions are very ripe, very perfect for us to achieve nirvana. And ultimately everybody will eventually achieve that. Now the equivalent of that, to me, seems to be Hegel, because he had this process whereby there would be like a dialectical process, I guess, which would lead to perfection. And he, I think the idea of perfection that he had, perhaps wasn't Nirvana, but it was something similar to that. But it was also a movement in a certain direction, and a particular, it's like a path that could be followed to achieve that. And to me, there is where this big similarity lies compared to other philosophers that we've been through so far.
Quite possibly. I know that most of what I know about Hegel comes through Schopenhauer, who despised him. So, but, you know, Hegel is actually quite difficult to read. But I see what you mean about that idea of progress and moving forwards. I think Schopenhauer felt it wasn't philosophically rigorous at all, but... I mean, that's what it is. We take from philosophy ideas which help us. So, well, it looks like there, you know, there could be so much more, couldn't there? There could be so much more that could be drawn from Western philosophy. But as I said, I haven't been able to give you more than just a bit of a taste and a look at some of my favourites. Actually, that's what I've done. It's been quite a personal look at it. And actually, 2 minutes. I mean, I did sort of try to draw out certain kind of parallels, or what Western philosophy can teach us in relation to Buddhism. Well, first of all, that the world cannot consist of independently existing objects, or at least it can, but it's very problematic to see that there are independently existing objects out there, and I'm an independently existing object. We cannot say that the world... Philosophy helps us to see that the world is not separate from our experience of it. We're actively involved in the construction of our worlds. And that's a huge topic, that we are constructing our own realities. And it's not quite... Well, we have to be careful with that, but there is certainly some truth in that. The idea, or Schopenhauer's idea of the noumenal not being... which I didn't really go into, the noumenal. There cannot be noumena. Noumena do not exist because the noumenal has to be one. It's not that every object there is a thing in itself, but there is the noumenal, which is the one.
I don't quite understand that. Is Schopenhauer saying that?
Schopenhauer is saying that, that's right. What he calls it, he says the noumenal cannot be differentiated because it's not in time or space, not subject to causality. It can't be differentiated, it cannot be plural, because if it was plural, it would be coming up against something else that wasn't. It's a bit difficult because, by its very nature, the noumenal cannot really be talked about. So that's why it's a bit like, you know, it's so tempting to say that the noumenal is like the unconditioned. Because as soon as something is differentiated, then it becomes one thing rather than another. So what Schopenhauer is saying, that a noumenal cannot be differentiated, otherwise you would you'd have to be saying that it's this and not that.
I didn't quite get it when you said that Schopenhauer read Kant and admired Kant, but
he
differed on causality.
I went over that very, very quickly, because Kant was suggesting that everything had a noumenal quality, there was something real.
Do you
which
mean there's an essence, everything's got an essence?
Yeah, in a way.
An essence
that's
absolutely real.
Which gives rise to our sense experience. So what he was saying is it seemed to be saying it's causing our sense experience. And Schopenhauer is saying you can't apply causality to something outside sense experience. Causality only applies to sense experience. So Kant had already said that. So he was just saying Kant was contradicting himself. So Schopenhauer was trying to find a way of accessing the noumenal, or having a sense of the noumenal, which didn't fall into that trap. It's a bit complex, actually. I could point you in the direction of Brian McGee's Confessions of a Philosopher, Schopenhauer himself, McGee's book on Schopenhauer, but I probably haven't got time to say much more at the moment. So, yeah.
But unlike Kant, he's not saying that there's loads of separate noumena things,
yeah, that's
all
right,
existing in themselves. He's saying that they all share this essence that is one thing that can't be perceived by sense experience.
Yes, in a way, that is what he's saying. He said there is a way of us accessing it through our inner experience, which is not sense experience. But I only had time to just touch on that, unfortunately.
No, I kind of get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really had, you know, kind of.
So did Schopenhauer mention it?
Sorry?
I mean, if he thought there was a way of accessing it through inner experience, did he have some form of education?
Well,
how did he get that?
By sustained thought, I think.
So he didn't actually meditate.
Well, he did contemplate. He talked about contemplation. Certainly contemplating art, because he felt that that was very important. But he doesn't really talk very much about meditation itself, although he was aware of meditation as a practice of Buddhists and Hindus, and he had a lot of respect for Buddhism and Hinduism.
I just wondered if he'd been influenced by...
Yes, I think he probably was, although there wasn't that much of Buddhism available to him.
Is that coming from Vedanta?
Yeah, a lot of it did come from Vedanta, he read widely from that. Yeah.
Somebody gave him a copy of the Upanishads as a young man.
That's right,
And that's where he got originally the Indian ideas from.
That's right. Anyway, that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid, folks. But so you're looking.